Welcome to the Roundtable panel for this morning. I'm Sarah LaDuc in for Joe Donahue. The music we're listening to today is from the relatively recent album All Living Things from Korean composer and multi-instrumentalist Park Ji-ha. So the album is called All Living Things, and we'll be hearing snippets of that this morning. Our panel today, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Oh, good morning. Good to be here.
Do you have any of the day that it is?
I do, actually. Today is actually Iwo Jima Day, and it's a remembrance of the horrific battle in World War II when America actually stood up to fascism rather than seemingly embracing it. So I would ask everybody to just take a moment and reflect a little bit on our history and where we are today versus where we have been.
Very important to remember. We're also joined by Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan doing a two-peat. Hello, Mayor Sheehan. How are you this morning?
I am well. I felt like I got called back into the classroom because I must have done something wrong yesterday.
Exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. And CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, is on her way. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Please do keep your letters relatively short, to the point, and on topic, and give them a quick proofread if you can before you send in for ease of live cold reading on the radio. Thank you very much for that. Again, panel@wamc.org. Let us begin with a local story. This coverage from our very own Where We Are, WAMC. Albany County Executive Dan McCoy gave his 14th State of the County address on Tuesday, that's yesterday, at the former campus of the College of St. Rose. Near the end of the address, McCoy said that Albany County provides a range of essential services to the city, often at a scale, he says, that is more cost-effective than current city operations. Quote, McCoy says, I believe it's time relevant to share services to create the most effective use of resources. If we were to consolidate services between the city and Albany and all the county, we could eliminate administrative costs, reduce bureaucracy overlap, ensure taxpayer dollars are spent more effectively together. We could build a smarter, leaner government that puts residents first. McCoy said that with current roundtable panelist and Mayor Kathy Sheehan, 12 years in office coming to an end, at her choice, the idea of consolidation offers a great opportunity to be open-minded. And with Mayor in studio, we wanted to discuss this address. What are your thoughts, Mayor Sheehan?
Well, a lot to unpack there.
Indeed.
It was all news to me. So the county executive has not talked to me about what he's thinking and what sorts of services that he believes the county is providing at scale in the city. I think it's important to recognize that I think there's very little overlap. There is some probably administrative overlap. We both have HR departments. We both have payroll departments. When I first
those departments are in place.
When I first became mayor, we did look at potentially combining some of that. We did not have an automated timekeeping system in the city when I took office. And so we looked at maybe piggybacking on the county's contract, and ultimately that was not feasible, so that didn't happen.
What is an automated timekeeping system?
Where you keep your time instead of writing when you come in and when you come out on a paper timesheet. We literally were paying people on paper timesheets when I became mayor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. So we did look at that, and ultimately that was not a feasible solution at the time, but always an opportunity to to look at those again and to reevaluate that. We also, prior to COVID, had been down a path pretty far with the sheriff on co-locating our dispatch centers, having one 911 dispatch center for the entire county. And again, there were some technical issues around that, and ultimately the determination was made by those who were looking at it at the time not to pursue that path. But again, certainly worth re-exploring. But I think other than that, there really is very little that is an overlap. The county is responsible for providing homelessness services, for example. We don't provide homelessness services. I think the county could certainly, take a harder look at how it delivers those services, because certainly there are definitely gaps. But it's not as though the city is duplicating those efforts. We don't provide mental health services, so there's no duplication of those efforts. You know, he talked a little bit about recreation. And again, I don't see duplication of services at this point. I think the county is doing some recreation programming in outlying towns and other areas of the county, but not directly in the city of Albany. But again, you know, I think we can certainly explore those things. And, you know, I'd very much like to know a little bit more about, you know, what the thought process is there and what the county executive is thinking. But as I said, you know, we have not had any substantive discussions about it. It was kind of the first that I was hearing of it. The county executive does periodically hold meetings where he calls together both elected and appointed officials from across the county to talk about opportunities for shared services. And so those are conversations that we have participated in on a relatively sporadic basis, but under the auspices of looking at opportunities. You know, none of us wants to waste taxpayer dollars. And so I think we have to look at, you know, how we are structured, what we are able to do, and what should happen at the city level. And again, you know, I really think we need a lot more robust services at the county level with respect to what we're seeing with homelessness, mental health and substance use issues. We've provided funding to the county to help support programming that the county is providing. But we don't want to duplicate efforts. That's why I have not hired a slew of caseworkers. I have not hired, you know, folks to be out there doing the work that the county is funded to do. And clearly, you know, we all would like more funding for that, but that they're really in the best position to oversee and to administer.
Bob, do you have any comments or thoughts or questions for the mayor?
Yeah, I mean, I've got several. One, I bristle a little bit at the inference that the city doesn't put citizens first, and the way I interpret some of the comments from the county leadership sort of was intimating that. And if that is not the case, then I certainly hope that he would come out and correct that. I'm going to talk about trust for a second. And there's a pattern developing in Albany County that as a resident, I find very, very disturbing. And this goes back to what we saw with the airport and the airport authority and the CEO. It's the shooting from the hip and talking about important but substantive policy changes, frankly, that should have been discussed with the city leadership prior to it being announced from the pulpit at St. Rose, which makes a difficult process of talking about consolidation of services even more difficult because it appears to be a zero-sum conversation. So from the block, I really push back on the way this is being handled. And in order for municipal services to be combined, you have to trust your partner, and you have to feel that the city is going to be protected. And right out from the block, this isn't the way you build trust in these relationships. And I think the mayor is absolutely correct. Nobody in the right mind stands against government efficiency, but you also have to be cognizant of government efficiency doesn't mean that you give up all of your powers and authorities. I mean, what we're seeing in D.C. is a prime example of what happens when that occurs. And I think this is a subject that deserves more conversation, but it needs to be done in a very different way than this was launched.
Mayor Sheehan?
Well, certainly I think that, you know, speaking to the focus on our residents, you know, that is the sole focus of what we do. The only reason that I have a job and the only reason that anyone who works for the city has a job is to provide service to the residents of the city of Albany and to those who come here to work and who are stakeholders in the city of Albany. And so that is the focus. You know, right now we're all dealing with the storm that we had over the weekend that has left sidewalks just caked with ice. And there's a lack of access right now and availability of salt that people can't purchase it if they want to. And so we've deployed to four different locations across the city salt that our residents, you have to demonstrate that you are a resident of the city of Albany, can come and pick up so that they're able to salt their sidewalks and make our streets safe for pedestrians and for people to get down the streets. I mean, that's what responsive government is. And I think that's why it's important at the local level to really focus on what is important at that local level, because every municipality is different. And so, you know, here in the city, we have kids that walk to school, and, you know, we're a densely populated city. And so this is an important issue for us, and this is how government responds. And I think, you know, I think there definitely could be more of a conversation, and I think it would be helpful for our residents and everyone to understand the different levels of government and why they exist. And so, you know, for example, when we talk about youth violence in the city of Albany, and it's very concerning, mm-hmm. we are arresting fewer juveniles. You know, they're committing fewer crimes. It's a smaller number of young people who are engaged in illicit and illegal behaviors, but those crimes are becoming more serious, right? So we're arresting fewer, but it's for more violent offenses. And so we have to work together to address those issues and to ensure that we're putting youth on the path, on a different path. And so how that gets funded, though, is at the county level. The county receives funding for youth diversion and for programs for youth. The city provides recreation program. We have our summer youth employment program. You know, we're really trying to meet kids before they get on the wrong path. But once they're on that path and they're involved with the courts or they're involved with the probation department, that is happening at a county level. And the programming and the services that are provided to help young people divert from that path are administered at the county level. There is an opportunity for us to work more closely together within that purview. But I think people need to understand it's not as though the city is operating a program and then the county is operating the same program and we're duplicating efforts. That's not how it's supposed to work. If we all work, you know, at the level that we're supposed to, I think we can go much further together. And so those are areas that I would love to explore with the county. And we started it with mental health outreach. Thanks to the county, thanks to the commissioner of the Department of Mental Health, they did a pilot on Lark Street. And in Washington Park, they realized that they needed case management out in the field, that they needed to understand what was preventing people from becoming sheltered and from choosing to seek treatment and come inside, and that they needed to do a lot more work where people were. And so we then said, okay, we can help fund that. We'll use our opioid resettlement money and we'll give it back to the county, because I don't want to manage caseworkers. I don't have anybody with that level of expertise that works for the city, but the county does, because they have a Department of Mental Health. So I think that's a really good example of one area where we are experiencing success, and there are probably more and more of those types of things that we could do together.
Jumping back to what you said about salt, where's the best place for listeners to find information about the locations so where the salt is available?
You can go to the city website. It's on our social media. But very quickly, we're at Westland Hills. We're at Ridgefield Park, Crank Park, and the Arbor Hills softball field in the parking lots. Again, you have to be a city resident. Bring your own bucket or bag. And we will be there today from noon to 6 and tomorrow from 8 to 6.
Thank you. Heather Mulligan is the CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Do you want to jump in on the county city story before we take a break?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. We do have a letter here from Janet, who said, I want to thank Mayor Sheehan for being at the pro-democracy rally at the Capitol. You gave a great speech, says Janet. Do you want to tell us about that event, Mayor Sheehan?
Well, you know, it was just an opportunity to acknowledge that at that rally, there were people who didn't agree with each other. But that is what democracy is all about. And when we come together and demand that the rule of law be followed and that we are ensuring that we're lifting up those who are being actually harmed by some of what we are seeing, and that there are real lives that are being impacted. And I use that opportunity, and I talked about it yesterday, to talk about the 150 refugees who are in the city of Albany right now, who were promised that we would help them for 90 days, and that promise was broken, and the office was closed down, and those services are not being provided. And so even though these individuals followed all of the rules, they are here legally, they did everything that they were supposed to do, they waited in line, and we said we'd help them for 90 days, which is not a really long time.
Nope.
And that help was shut off. And that's not just because of the executive order that was then overturned, or temporarily suspended. This was part of a separate executive order. And now these individuals, there are community organizations that are coming together to help them. But I lifted that up as an example because, you know, if we can break that promise, then to those who are filing their taxes right now expecting a child tax credit, what happens if President Trump signs an executive order and says, you know what, we're not going to give that to you? Or if somebody has been approved for a hip replacement by Medicaid and an executive order comes out and says, we're not going to do any of this, we're going to freeze all of this. You know, there are real people behind these decisions. And right now we have 150 people, as I said, in the city of Albany who the promise was broken. And to me, we have to ensure that we're speaking up for those who are being impacted by this, because who is it going to be next?
Panelists this morning on the roundtable panel are Bob Griffin, Heather Mulligan, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan. You can join the conversation by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. Please keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Proofread them if you have a moment before sending, and don't include links or attachments, as we, you know, can't really click through, absorb, and read aloud to share with the conversation. But do, you know, send us your questions and comments as you wish. panel@wamc.org, and we will return after a brief news break from the BBC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in studio with Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan. We are awaiting news from the governor's office and the New York City mayor's office about what will happen. And we've discussed it a lot on the roundtable panel the last few days. But I did want to ask you directly, Mayor Sheehan, if you think that Mayor Adams should resign.
I certainly think that it's very difficult for him to focus on the issues that matter to average New Yorkers and to be able to continue to do the work. And I think that that's the piece of this that is really important, because, you know, of course, people are innocent until proven guilty. And I'm not suggesting, you know, that there is, I don't want to opine on that. Right. But I certainly think there does come a point at which it's very difficult to govern. And when four of your deputy mayors resign and it's difficult to replace those positions, particularly in an election year, there is an election coming up, that it's getting more and more difficult. And I think, you know, he has to listen to New Yorkers, and it's the people of New York City that have to decide what they want to see happen here. And ultimately, hopefully, he will listen to those opinions. It sounds as though there are a majority of
New
Yorkers
as though
who would like to see him step aside. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean he can't still run, you know, but I think that it's very difficult. I mean, the process for the governor to remove him is so convoluted. And given that it's an election year and there's going to be a primary in 4 months, I don't know what purpose would be served by that. And I don't think that it would result in a better administration of city services. So I think it's a very difficult situation.
I feel like
you're a little far from your mic.
I feel like I'm on a different planet on this one, just because they don't resign when he's under indictment. They don't resign when he's facing felony charges. They resign when the charges are going to be dismissed. And they resign because...
You mean they call for him to resign?
No. The deputy mayors.
Oh, the deputy mayors.
The deputy
mayors,
they're fine being deputy mayors when he's facing a felony indictment. What they object to is him cooperating with the federal government. I guess, or the deal, the so-called quid pro quo. But he was calling for help from the federal government during the Biden administration, and he didn't get it. So I guess I get it. Everyone hates him. Like, the people who live in the city can't stand him. But there is an election this year. I think the governor would be making a huge mistake if she were to remove him, because he is duly elected. And I know, like, people are going to put a hate on me for saying this, but I think there's a certain irony in the fact that, like, when the charges are going away.
I think that's exactly why they're resigning. Look, if you are subjecting yourself to the legal process, you are entitled to justice.
Right.
But when you make a deal that makes those charges go away,
giving anything
so that
deal.
You're not. How do we even know that? That is transparent as a black box. We have no idea.
He's been asking for this the whole time. He's been asking for help.
Look,
I mean, he's been begging the federal government to come help him. I don't see anything.
And so why drop the charges? If this president just wanted to help him and all he wanted was help, why would he even ask for the charges to be dropped?
Maybe because of the exact reason that they put on the paper, which is he's spending so much time fighting the charges, and the prospect of having to be in court all this time makes it impossible for him to assist them. I mean, whatever. They didn't have to give any reason to drop the charges. I think their mistake was putting any reason. I mean, they could have just dropped the charges and said nothing. They didn't have to say, and it's because, you know, he won't be able to help us in this, you know, what I think is very, you know, going in and removing people who we think are, I'm not saying that it's a nice plan or a good plan or anything. What I'm saying is he's saying that he's going to do what he's been asking for all along. Can you please help me with all of these immigrants? Give us help. Give us money. Federal government, please step in. He'd been asking the Biden administration to do that. So what they're saying he's going to cooperate with is what he's been saying all along he wanted. I don't see I don't see him changing his position. And that's what a quid pro quo is, doing something that you wouldn't otherwise do, taking an official act that you wouldn't otherwise do but for. And so that's the problem I'm having with it. But maybe I'm thinking myself into a corner here. I'm totally open to that interpretation. I just think she'd be making a mistake if she removed him, because it's an election year and, you know, he was duly elected. We've got a primary coming up. The voters can have their say. If they don't want him to be mayor anymore, you know, we're essentially, you know, a matter of, you know, a couple months away from them having the ability to make that decision. So, you know, to take that act for the first time in the history, you know, based on this sort of very kind of crazy out there deal that was put on paper, which I'm like, I can't believe they said this out loud. You know, this is the kind of thing I think happens quite frequently. Usually people don't say it out loud.
Bob Griffin is going to furrow his eyebrows into oblivion if we don't let him weigh in.
Yeah,
here
no,
you go, Bob.
I'm in agreement that I think the governor is showing due prudence, particularly given the time before an election process. It's interesting, you know, Mary, you talk about the presumed innocence that we have in our legal system. But what happens when the legal system is manipulated in a way that denies the people the access to information about what's going on? And this is where I really disagree with you, Heather, is that I do think there's a quid pro quo here, and if we're not even talking about the fact that the prosecutors, the federal prosecutors who resigned. Okay, I'm not worried about about Adams' deputies. I'm thinking about what the professional prosecutors said is tantamount to malfeasance, judicial malfeasance, on behalf of the Department of Justice. That investigation should continue on, because we the people have the right to understand what is going on. We should also have the right to understand, if there is a quid pro quo, what that means. So while I agree with the governor, I think the investigation should have gone on. It does look nefarious to me. And until such time as somebody can show me where it's not, then this thing stinks to high heaven and he's part of it.
I'm a former defense attorney. I also worked in the Albany County DA's office all through law school. And I understand the concept, but if you were to apply that, I mean, it happens all the time, plea bargains. In a plea bargain, someone agrees to testify against co-defendants. The prosecutor asks them to do that in exchange for a reduced sentence. Mm-hmm. They are getting a sentence that is different than what they would get otherwise in exchange for their cooperation, which is something that they wouldn't otherwise do, but for this. It is a deal.
But you have to disclose that deal, and it has to be
and this is disclosed.
Open
it's
and
a
public.
Letter.
And I think that this, the reasoning for this, you know, again, he's going to cooperate with, and it's not a deal that the prosecutors in the office made, right? This is coming from the Justice Department telling them what to do. And I think that is where people are really, understandably, right, alarmed and concerned that if this is the transactional nature of how things go moving forward, right, then what has really happened to the rule of law? Because, and I think this is something that people were concerned about, mm-hmm, with a Trump presidency, that this is about, it's not about justice, it is about making deals.
Yeah, I mean, I listen, there's the limousine case. I mean, there's examples where deals are made that people don't like, and sometimes they get rejected. An elected DA has the ability to tell his line assistant district attorneys, you are going to make this deal, right? And their only option is to quit. This is transparent. It's in a letter. I was surprised that it was in the letter. And the authority of the head of DOJ has the person at the head of DOJ has the ability to direct the assistant, you know, U.S. attorneys at a lower level. They do not have the authority to override. They have the ability to resign if they don't like it. I'm not suggesting for one instance that this isn't bad, that this isn't a bad deal, all of those things. I guess my thought is this is the process playing out how it frequently does. And I think that it's a little interesting that the resignations are happening in this context. And then I go back to, you know, the Senator Menendez, which I know some people won't see as a parallel, but here's a guy who was multiple indictments, you know, could have been easily forced into a resignation, but wasn't, because you had basically very close numbers holding the Democrats in control of the U.S. Senate. And if he had resigned, you know, it would have created a political problem. So they basically let him stay while he was under.
So, but where's Menendez right now?
Well, yeah, he's in prison.
He's in prison.
No,
okay.
I got that.
But I mean, I also have a problem with the fact that we're talking about a political corruption case involving an elected official.
He's not been convicted.
He hasn't been convicted because they're stopping the investigation.
Well, we don't know.
We know, Heather.
No. We don't know that that's why he hasn't been convicted. If there's a trial, he still may not be convicted.
But there will never be a trial because they've stopped the investigation.
This is without prejudice. So there could be a trial still.
Okay.
Panel at WAMC.org. Many more stories to get into this morning, but we will take a brief underwriting break and return shortly. Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel in studio with Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan. I would like to read one letter about the Adams conversation, and then we will let you guys comment again, and then we need to move on to other stories. But we're not done with this, so let's go. Here is from Telesport. This letter to panel at WAMC.org email says, the problem with Ms. Mulligan's plea bargain analogy is that such a bargain is within the criminal system. Political favors are never part of a plea bargain. And there's also the fact that there is a plea. That's one comment.
I don't see how that is different. I mean, cooperating legally within the bounds of the law, agreeing to cooperate with a sitting president who's been duly elected is not an illegal act. I'm not sure what the illegality is there.
Mayor Sheehan?
Well, I think just coming back, though, to resignations, and I really am more talking about the resignations that happened, within the U.S. Attorney's Office. Mm-hmm. But I think that is how people respond. I mean,
yep.
If you don't like the deal, to your point, then you can resign. And
yep.
I think that there are those who are using, they're seeing something that has just gone a bridge too far, and they're saying, I'm not going to be a part of it. And so I respect that, and I think that is part of what we're going to see, and we're going to continue to see, because there are those who are going to say, no, I do not want to be a part of this. And we're presuming a lot with respect to the legality of what the Trump administration wants to do. You know, there are all of these court cases right now questioning the legality of a lot of the things that
right.
they're doing.
Yep.
So I think those are very concerning to people.
Yeah. And I to be clear, I think the U.S. attorneys, and I think I said this, that is, you know, that is the thing that they do, right? They resign. They can't just disobey. They're acting at the direction of the head of DOJ, right? So that is their choice. My point on the resignations was the deputy mayors, which, you know, they were fine acting as deputy mayors while he was under indictment for felonies for supposedly taking bribes or allegedly. I'm not questioning whether that's true or not. I don't know, right? There has not been a trial. But they're okay with that. The problem they have is when the charges are being withdrawn. And he basically is making a public deal to cooperate with the federal government for something that he's been asking them to do all along, right? So there's been no public change in position on his part. So I guess I'm curious as to what the egregious act that he has committed is that would justify the deputy mayor's resignations.
And again, I don't think we know what he's agreed to do and what that's going to look like.
I think that's very public.
Concerning to people.
Yeah.
Very concerning. It's one thing to ask for monetary help. It's one thing to say, you know, we need more shelter. We need more funding to address this issue. And it's another thing to make whatever we just don't know what
right.
that deal is.
I'm only going by what's been publicly stated. And that's what has been commented on. Right. So
I also will go back to the fact that there's a disturbing trend from Donald Trump of pardoning and alleviating or blocking public corruption investigations, trials, and outcomes. So you think about both his first term and second term. And to me, running for public office and holding public office is is something that is almost sacred, that there's that we the people cede our civil rights and liberties to our elected representatives. That's how the government works. And if there are processes in place that protect the corrupt, that mm-hmm. the whole system again crumbles. So I look at this and I don't, Heather, disagree with you on the deputy mayors, that it feels like it's an opportune time to get out of Dodge. What bothers me still more is the Justice Department ordering the end of an investigation into potential public corruption at the felony level. And that this will then become the standard that this administration will use to forgive, forget behavior that weakens both state and local laws. So I recognize it's a federal case, but I mean it has implications to the rest of us.
And to your point, I mean I agree. Nobody should get a pass to be corrupt. I don't think being elected should give you some kind of freedom. It still to this day drives me crazy that Eliot Spitzer never faced any charges, that he was allowed to just resign when what he did was a felony, and any normal human being would have been punished, probably done prison time. I mean, he multiple times moved money to hire, you know, I don't know why the press always refers to it as high-end prostitutes. I mean, I'm not sure, maybe just expensive, right? prostitutes across state lines.
Sex workers.
And basically in violation of a statute that he helped write. Yeah. I mean, this was like flouting a law that he helped write. It was very egregious, and he resigned, and that was it. And there was no prosecution. Nobody went after him. And why? Oh, because his resignation was enough of a punishment. I don't think that's right. No. You know, and I think that people should be subject to the law at the same level. I represented people who had no resources and were treated very differently than people who had resources. I think the system should be fair, and it should be applied the same way to everyone regardless. So I'm not suggesting that, the use of pardons or political leverage to forgive people so that you can get something out of them at a higher level or because they've got something to give is a valid way to run a justice system. Yeah. I don't think that's the case at all. I just think that this is one of those things where we're seeing all of this out in public, and I think that it's very interesting, and we're seeing a lot of hypocrisy.
Including a felon who is the president of the United States.
Speaking of the governor of New York State, another rather large problem on her plate this week, Governor Kathy Hochul mentioned on Tuesday that she may have to use the National Guard to ensure the safety of New York's prisons after wildcat strikes by corrections officers spread to more than half of the state's 42 penitentiaries. This coverage from the New York Times, but I know the New York Public News Network is also looking at it, covering it, and there will be updates. The threat was a response to labor actions that began on Monday, with officers assigned to two upstate prisons refusing to come to work to protest staff shortages and other conditions. By Tuesday, strikes had emerged at 25 prisons, state officials said. The officers' union said it had not authorized the job actions, and Governor Hochul called them illegal and unlawful. She said she was considering forcing the officers back to work by invoking a state law that prohibits most public employees in New York State from going out on strike. Quote the governor, "We will not allow these individuals to jeopardize the safety of their colleagues, incarcerated people, and the residents of the communities surrounding our correctional facilities." The Times Union reported this month that the union had issued a vote of no confidence in the commissioner of the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, Daniel Marticello, in part because a reduction in the number of officers has forced the union's members to work overtime in increasingly dangerous conditions. Anger at the commissioner appears to have increased after he issued a memo to prison superintendents last week in which he said the department would have to get by with 70% of its typical workforce because of the persistent staff shortages. The striking officers, whose current three-year contract runs through March 26, refuses to accept the smaller force as permanent, and increasing its size is among their demands. Bob, would you like to start this one?
I actually think in this situation the governor should invoke the law. Public employees should not be allowed to go on strike, especially those that affect the health and well-being of our communities. Again, it gets back to the earlier conversation we were just having about the mayor, is that when you work in the public sector, you accept a different set of responsibilities than you do if you're working in the private sector. I will also say that a couple points. One is that I think the staffing levels in the prison system really need to be reviewed.
Yeah.
And that the workers in the correctional facilities and their families have the right to go to work in a safe environment as they possibly can. I also worry that, you know, in bringing the National Guard into the situation, these are folks that are not trained as correctional employees, and that is also a recipe for potential disaster. I will also say that this is going to be a long-term problem because just don't go take people off the street and say, come in and be a correctional officer. I mean, it's training. It's getting the pipeline in place is not going to be an insignificant problem, but it's something that I think the lawmakers in New York really need to prioritize. I mean, this is sort of fundamental in my mind to us being a just country, is that it's not just justice, but for it's equity of delivery of justice for both the prisoners and the people that work in the correctional institutions. I will also argue that I like the governor. I think that we do have too many prisons in the state of New York, and we should be talking about consolidation. And I recognize that creates pain to places that this is a primary industry. But I think that also raises questions that we as New Yorkers should be conversations we should be having about: do we really want our primary, businesses in some areas to be incarceration? And that's a very different conversation. So, to sort of sum up, I think the Wildcat strikes are illegal. The governor should step in strongly here, and that this is not the way to achieve the policy gains or desires that the correctional officers are looking for. I also don't like the idea that this is also being used as a way of trying to draw attention to policy and law changes that they are unhappy with. That we didn't really talk about that, but there's also the use of different forms of incarceration, like isolation, that were changed in state law that the correctional officers don't like. That's not the way laws are written. That's not the way laws are made. So that's another issue. With that said, I would ask that the lawmakers actually talk to the experts before they go passing legislation that has some of these impacts. And I think there's been a divide. There's been a big gap between some of our prison reforms versus what's actually implementable and safe within the facilities.
I think that the tidiest way to break up this conversation with a newscast is to take the break now, and we will return to discuss it more after we hear a regional newscast with Ray Graff. The roundtable panel this morning: Bob Griffin, Heather Mulligan, Kathy Sheehan. I'm Sarah LaDuc, and we will return after the news. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuc here with Bob Griffin, Heather Mulligan, and Kathy Sheehan. We are discussing the wildcat strikes at correctional facilities in New York State and the governor's response. And as Bob mentioned before the break, another major point of contention, this is from the New York Times, is a state law that took effect in 2022 that strictly limits who can be placed in solitary confinement and for what reason and how long they can be kept there. When it was passed by the legislature, the law was hailed as a groundbreaking measure that would fundamentally change life for the people behind bars. But the officers' union has said that the restrictions endanger them and incarcerated people alike, and the strikers are demanding that law be reversed. So we want to add that to the conversation, as Bob intelligently did. Thank you, Bob. And look for first reactions from Mayor Sheehan.
Sure. Well, I think even the union understands that is not within the power of the people that they would be negotiating their contract with, that this is a law. And so there needs to be a process for addressing that. And I am a huge believer that you need to talk to the people who are doing these jobs and get an understanding of what they are actually experiencing day in and day out before you legislate. But don't get me started. As an executive, I'm often frustrated with my legislative branch and some of the things that they want to do. And I do push back on them. We have council members who, for all good and well intentions, propose legislation. And I will say to them, well, you're expecting the police department, for example, to enforce this. Have you spoken to the police chief? Have you spoken to the police union? Have you talked to officers about, from a practical standpoint, what is this going to entail? So I think that's important. But I think very quickly, I just want to say that the reality of a 70% workforce, and I didn't read the letter, I don't know what was in the letter, but you cannot just create a prison guard tomorrow. You can't fill those positions tomorrow. And so we have the same issue with our police department. And it is so challenging. And the fact that we are inversing our officers, that they are working the hours that they are working, it is not acceptable to me. And so I think it's important for those of us in elected office and commissioners to acknowledge that and to say that. This is not okay. It's not okay. And these are the steps that we're taking to try to address it. One of the things that we're doing with our police department is we're bringing somebody in to really look at the jobs that we're doing, because we have to reimagine the job. If we are not going to be able to recruit quality people, because we can't lower our standards, these jobs require people who have the ability to work under pressure, to de-escalate very dangerous situations, to put themselves in danger. These are jobs that require the right people. And so you can't lower the standards. And I don't think those who are on the job now would want us to lower the standards, whether it's prison guards or police officers. So what do we do to maximize the time that is spent doing those parts of the job and take things off of our officers' plates that maybe don't require somebody with that skill set and that level that can be done more administratively? And so we have to reimagine these jobs. And I think we have to reimagine the prison system. And, you know, many of the good points that were made, consolidating, looking for opportunities to think differently about the places and spaces and the amount of resource that is needed given the current footprint of the prison system in New York State. That has to be part of the conversation, because there's no cavalry. And, you know, we had 110 people take the police exam. We are now giving the police exam virtually every 4 months. Fortunately, thanks to the cooperation from the New York State Civil Service Commission, we are working to try to increase the number of applicants and the number of recruits that we're able to hire. But where we used to have 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 people taking the test, we now have 100, 120, 125. You might get 10 qualified officers out of that pool of test takers. And then of those, once they get into the academy, you're going to lose some of them. And so this is a real challenge, and we have to reimagine these jobs. And we as leaders have to talk to the people who are doing the jobs and figure out what we can do to address these very serious quality of life, safety issues that these corrections officers are talking about.
The state police said on Tuesday they are assisting the corrections department by providing outer perimeter security at some prisons where officers are striking. Jennifer Scaife is the executive director of the Correctional Association of New York, a state prison oversight group. She said that officers at prisons across the state had complained to the association of regularly having to work 16-hour shifts. Such schedules were unsustainable and a sign of crisis in the prison system, she said. But she also noted the strikers were demanding things that the governor could not provide unilaterally, as we've said. Prisoners' rights groups have criticized the strikes, and one accused strikers of trying to divert attention from the death of Mr. Brooks in an upstate New York prison recently. Heather.
So I have to say, I first strongly agree with everything that has been said so far. I think that the thing that, you know, to me is really sort of gut-wrenching is there are people who are incarcerated that the people who are supposed to be taking care of them are on strike. What, you know, this is really, really frightening and inhumane. And I mentioned on air a number of times, a former public defender. I think that we are a society that over-incarcerates. I think incarceration should be an absolute last resort. I think it creates outcomes that put people in a place where as much as we like to talk about it as rehabilitative, it really isn't. We are not a society that tends to forgive, that right. tends to give second chances.
Recidivism rates indicate not a lot of rehab.
I mean, there's not a lot of opportunities for people once they've been incarcerated. I think that incarceration really should be a last resort to begin with. It is appalling to me that someone would think about leaving someone who is incarcerated, who cannot, they can't fend for themselves, they can't feed themselves, they don't. So I'm hopeful that someone is sent in to at least make sure that there's order maintained, that the food is, you know, sent in, that, you know, someone is keeping the lights on and keeping them
and the heat,
right. There is a very, very big problem with the system, and it's not just the inmates, and it's not just whether or not they can use solitary confinement, which is a terrible last resort of last resorts, right? I mean, it has severe psychological consequences to the people who experience it. These are all factors, but we really need to reevaluate, prison and incarceration an economic development tool for communities that are hollowed out because we have policies that drove manufacturing out of upstate New York communities? I mean, these are really big systemic policy issues. And at the core of all of it is a reluctance to listen, and Bob said this, to expertise, to people who will, with expertise, advise and guide policymakers. And we have really gone away from that. We are very much, you're either for the police or against the police. You're either for the environment or against the environment. And it's black or white. You're either on this side of the aisle or that side of the aisle. We really need to do a lot more conversing, a lot more thoughtful discussion about how we build policies around incarceration and listen to experts about what works and what doesn't work. Why are we having trouble recruiting police officers? I don't know. There's a huge part of society that says defund the police or doesn't like and then there's the great blue wall and there's dirt on everyone's hands. There's problems on both sides, but really there are underlying issues, societal issues that are behind all of this. But it is unacceptable to leave people who are not able to feed themselves, to take care of themselves, to leave them and use that as leverage in this society. That is not okay.
Bob?
I think there's a couple of interesting points that we can sort of go down any one of these rabbit holes. One of the interesting points that sort of bubbled up is a discussion about the American workforce. Mm-hmm. And what happens when positions that we deem are critical to our society, people don't want to do that? What do we do as a society in order to promote, to fill sort of critical positions? And I know that gets into everything from economic development to taxation policy to, frankly, respect and
training and locations,
everything—it's all connected. Exactly,
right.
I don't see anywhere the political will to have conversations. I hear people go after, the younger generations don't want to do this. Maybe they're smarter than we are. Maybe they're smarter than saying that, no, I'm not going to be a slave to a 60, 70-hour work week rather than saying the younger generation is lazy, we're saying that maybe we need to start to have an overall conversation about what our work weeks look like. But again, this is where you start to have a federal, that should be a national conversation, which is really difficult. And I do hearken back to what's going on with the federal workforce right now, where the level of disrespect that the federal workforce is receiving is going to bite this country right in the keister. Because why anybody who's talented and cares about the country would go into service right now, when frankly they're being fired in probationary periods. Excellent employees who have excellent reviews are being fired. Why would anybody want to do that? And it sort of raises the same question of why does anybody want to go into public service if it's it's a threat to your life. You don't feel like you're compensated. You don't feel like you're appreciated. But boy, there's a really important conversation about our collective future right now. And it does link back with immigration. It does link back with who's going to do these jobs. And these just are really tough conversations. But there's a growing crisis in this country that we need to be aware of. My mother was in the emergency room last night. she fell and she broke her wrist. My mom has dementia, so it's even more difficult. She was in the ER for 9 hours last night, okay? Seven before she saw a doctor. There aren't enough healthcare specialists to take care of us. What are we doing about it? Where's the conversation on it?
And I think that's where we have to demand more of leadership. And so when we think about reimagining prisons, well, we all know that there is a shocking number of people with serious mental illness in our prisons. That's where people with serious mental health issues often end up now. They don't end up in a hospital or in a facility to treat their mental illness. Well, we know that they're there. Maybe the 30% of the jobs that are missing are jobs of mental health professionals and providers who can assist people who have committed crimes, they've gone to prison, but they also have serious mental health issues. Imagine if we treated them. I mean, that would be a remarkable positive for prison guards, for the work that they're doing, for the others who are incarcerated and maybe incarcerated with somebody who has a very serious untreated mental health issue, and outcomes, you know, to Heather's point of what is it, why are we incarcerating people and what do we want the outcome to be?
Right, yeah.
And so getting the help that you need. So these are the conversations and the seriousness with which we need to be approaching these challenges. And as our workforce ages, as we cut off the spigot with respect to immigration, and I'm a huge proponent, I want immigration to be done right. I don't want people with criminal records coming into my community. Nobody wants that. We want common sense immigration rules of the road that everybody knows and can follow. And so these are things that we need to be demanding. And I think instead we get into our bubbles and we politicize everything. And it makes it very difficult to do the work that needs to be done. I'm a huge believer. Let's roll up our sleeves and do this work. We can solve this. But we have to be willing to talk to one another. We have to be willing to take the politics out of it. We have to stop what we're doing now because it's not working. And it's having real life consequences for people whose lives are now in danger.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just wanted to add to your, like, I like this, like, solution, positive thinking and everything. And I had this, and I actually, a couple of years, more than a couple of years ago, before the pandemic, was talking about these upstate communities where the prisons are, they are places where, yes, there's not a lot of industry anymore, but they're great places if you are remote. If the infrastructure is there for internet, for Wi-Fi, you have affordable housing. You have really, really cool little downtown areas. You have old banks. You have great infrastructure. You have beautiful outdoor areas. I mean, these are places that are affordable. And so there's an opportunity that is sitting there. Some of these places are absolute gems. There is an opportunity for upstate New York, for some of these communities to repackage themselves, remarket themselves. There's some really, really beautiful places that have been maybe neglected a little bit that have a chance to rebuild themselves as people have more and more opportunity to work from home. So, yeah, maybe they're not going to be, you know, manufacturing hubs anymore. Maybe as prisons get repurposed, there won't be as many of these in-person large employers in these communities. But there's still very affordable housing, and there's still good infrastructure in these communities, and we should take advantage of that, market it, and you know what? We don't have some of the problems a lot of other states have. We don't have a history of wildfires. And I mean, we do have right now a lot of ice, and I'm so sick of it. But, you know, it's relatively minor compared to some of the other
days,
stuff. So.
Yeah. Bob mentioned the layoffs at the federal level throughout the departments, you know, implemented by the Trump administration and DOGE. And we should discuss that. There's a lot to launch, and we'll, you know, pick at it as we can. Federal turmoil from the New York Times. The Trump administration fired 168 probationary workers at the National Science Foundation, a spokesman said. That cuts more than 10% of the workforce at the agency, which, along with the National Institute of Health, is a cornerstone of public research funding in the United States. Separately, Jim Jones, the director of the Food and Drug Administration's food division, resigned on Monday, citing what he called indiscriminate layoffs that would make it fruitless for him to continue. As Mr. Musk's team proceeds, probationary workers at the Pentagon are one of the next targets, with mass layoffs expected, and the Trump administration fired about 1,300 additional employees at the Interior Department over the holiday weekend, according to two people familiar with the matter, adding to the widespread purge of thousands of federal workers. The administration had also fired about 1,000 other department employees at the National Park Service. Where shall we begin with all of that?
It sounds to me like they're picking their probationary workers because they think that they don't need a real reason to fire them. From what I've heard and read, they're all being told that their performance wasn't up to snuff also as part of the communication, which was like a cut and paste thing. But it sounds like it's not every probationary worker. So it's unclear at this point if it's every single probationary worker, which is like 200,000 maybe probationary workers right now.
And they're probationary only because of when they were hired. They're in like
right. It's a 1 year. It's essentially assessment a 1 year period, right? Yes.
It could be two, or it could even be if you are. See, this is what people
aren't. If you haven't had a review.
If you accepted a promotion, then you're put on probationary status.
Okay.
I mean, and you're right that there are people. They are using the excuse. I've seen a couple of the letters that have said, you know, because of performance.
Right.
Which, I mean, I don't like paying taxes to deal with stupidity from policymakers, but I think a lot of these people have a damn good lawsuit, and I hope they get a good attorney and they sue the heck out of the government for what's going on. The other thing. That I'm hearing, speaking with people last night, I spoke with people, it's almost a constant therapy session right now.
Mm-hmm.
But Friday there should be another tranche. And again, if somebody is not performing, okay, then I understand. But let me give you a for instance of what's going on with this current administration. They fired the chief financial officer for FEMA. And the reason that they gave for the termination was because they didn't like the fact that she paid invoices. She paid invoices that were legitimate bills that the Office of General Counsel said the government had to pay because the government had entered into contract with the business. But the administration didn't like the business and terminated for that. So think about that. So she got terminated for paying a bill that the government agreed to pay in order to for the services to be delivered. That's what's going on right now. And to me, it's even sillier is that what I'm hearing from a couple of the different agencies is at the same time they're being told they have to fire probationary employees. They're also being told that there isn't a hiring freeze and that they can refill the positions. Okay? So to me, it's like, well, it becomes a game that we're gonna
not
hold
a
this
fun
up.
One.
This is sick and twisted. Okay? The rancid creamsicle that's the top of this administration is out of control. And, you know, if Clarence Thomas is listening to the show, which I doubt because he'd get educated and that's not something he's big on, the ruling on immunity and presidential immunity is going to destroy this country. But it's a game that's being played to say, look, look how many useless bureaucrats we got rid of. They don't tell you what's not now going to be done. Okay. They also are celebrating the fact that American citizens are being laid off. And if Ford was doing this or if GM was doing this, it would be a crisis. But, you know, they're talking about hundreds of thousands of layoffs. You know, folks, wake up. What is this going to do to the overall economy? You don't think this is going to be a drag on the overall economy? Then you're absolutely crazy. Not only that, but it's purposely meant to club into submission a bureaucracy that is designed to be experts, to give their experts' opinion when this group doesn't want the expert opinion and doesn't want anybody who is going to stand up to them and tell them that this is not what they should be doing.
Mayor Shan?
And I think telling those stories is going to be really important because this is impacting average Americans and communities and the outcomes I'm very concerned about. And these are, you know, whether it's the farmer in Iowa whose grain is rotting in his silos because USAID was shut down, or it is, you know, the family that can't get the assistance that they needed if there's a natural disaster. The fact that this is, again, very deal driven. If we like you, we'll pay you. If we don't, we won't. I know of communities that are responding to this I heard one mayor actually say that they had been advised to take pictures down from their website because it looked too diverse. So these are the stories that need to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have to, unfortunately, this behavior is going to continue. It is going to do damage unchecked, even with some of the stays and the court rulings that have come down the pike. This is impacting real people. So maybe this summer, when people get turned away from visiting our national parks because there's no one there to work, or somebody gets seriously hurt, these are the things that we need to collect and to know and to talk about, because this is impacting real people, real hardworking people across the country.
Welcome to the final segment of this morning's roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, here with Bob Griffin, Heather Mulligan, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan. We are discussing the mass layoffs at the federal level that have been filtering through the news of late. And we heard from Mayor Sheehan before the break. Heather.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add, except that, you know, we were talking about the difficulty in recruiting people to become police officers and correctional officers. I can't imagine how hard it's going to make it to fill some of these federal government positions when you have this kind of sort of, you know, no notice and seemingly unpredictable isn't even the right word, just sort of mass layoffs without any rational basis other than we're just reducing headcount, kind of like a corporate reduction, you know, like that's how it feels to me. Like, you know, somebody didn't hit their profits number this quarter, so we're going to lay off 10% of our workforce, right? I mean, that's got that feel, right?
It does. And you can pull
I don't think right your mic is on.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, we're in a period right now of some of the most intense airline incidents that we've had in decades. Why would you be laying off air traffic controllers right now? And then why would you lay them off and then go try to rehire them? I mean, it sort of begs the question of, again, what's the plan? I mean, what's the purpose? What's the plan? What are you really doing?
I don't know.
See, and right, but I can't even figure out the concept of the plan other than what I saw in Project 2025. But what?
I don't think this was in there, though. I mean,
I think dismantling these agencies was. Yeah. And, you know, look, part of what civil servants are supposed to do is keep the motor running, keep the engines of government moving in the direction that they're supposed to be moving, right? Paying the vouchers for Section 8. They do that irrespective of the political party that's in office. And we, I think, have an administration that has not and does not respect that line should be there, that there are certain jobs, right? Civil service was created so that the elected officials couldn't just bring in their hacks and displace an entire workforce, and that there would be some stability around the things that government does, like getting out Social Security checks, right? Auditing our taxes, reviewing taxes, making sure that airplanes land safely, all of these things that I think many of us probably take for granted. But those are supposed to be jobs that are filled by people, not because of the political party that they belong to or, you know, who they helped get elected, but because they are civil servants who are doing a job. And I think we, Project 25 did imagine dismantling this civil service system. And I presumably to ensure that only those who are in lockstep with the administration have any hope of actually filling these jobs and being part of the administration.
But they're laying off people that voted for this administration. I mean, it just seems
Who knows?
Oh no, I was listening to a podcast this morning, and the guy was like, "Yeah, I voted for him twice, and I would still vote for him." But this, you know, this isn't the way to accomplish what I thought he was going to accomplish. It's interesting. I mean, there's sort of a I don't know anyone who watches Severance. There's some kind of Severance feel to some of this.
Yes, there is.
I was listening to the underground file cabinet story from last week. I don't know if anyone knows what the heck I'm talking about, but there's apparently this underground mine that has all of the retirement paperwork. And it's like massive file cabinet systems because all the paperwork has to be actually on paper, because the way that they change the check boxes, you can't do it on computers for some reason. So you can only a certain number of people can retire every year from the federal government because of the length of time it takes to actually fully process the retirement. This is all true. I mean, unless the New York Times is lying about it, which I don't think they are. They did this full-blown episode on it. But there's this land in some state where all of these people work in this underground, not a bunker, it's like an old mine that's just filled with thousands and thousands mm-hmm. of file cabinets. And what they do is they process the paperwork for retirement. And this mass layoff thing almost sounds like, well, they realize that they can't force all these people to retire. So when they offered the retirements and then some people took it and they said, oh, wait, we're not going to do these retirements anymore, like, because we can't, because it'll take too long. Now they're just laying off this plan B is we're just going to lay off, you know, all the people who are in their probationary period.
Yeah, but it's even more insidious than that, though. I mean, the people who are in the probationary period are typically your younger employees yeah. who, you know, you as a good company, you want to groom, you want to train. That they're going to be your future leadership. I mean, it's basically eating your seed corn for the future, mm-hmm. and making it such a disgusting place to work that very few people in their right mind are going to want to do it. So, yeah. I mean, it's tumultuous and
unreliable employment is not what you need.
Right.
Yeah, but the hire back thing, I mean, is there an alternative theory of the case there that these are all people who are hired in the last year of the Biden administration, so they are clearly Biden loyalists, and if we just I'm trying to figure out in what planet does this make any kind of sense?
Right.
Well, I don't know if they all were hired in the last year of the Biden administration, clearly they must all like Biden. Get rid of them, and then we'll re-interview everyone, and they would then be Trump loyalists because they started on our watch. I mean, I'm not saying that makes any sense. I'm just trying to think of, like,
I mean, I got a couple of planets that I could tell you. One is that if you are looking to institutionalize a tax cut for the very rich, anything that you can do to make that as cost neutral as possible, even at the expense of everybody else, that's one crazy planet that we could be living on.
But how does hiring people back accomplish that?
That is, and this is where conspiracy looking like incompetence may play a role. The other piece of it, though, is that
or incompetence looking like conspiracy. I don't know.
Yeah, but when you have, you know, I'm thinking about inauguration and I'm looking at the oligarchs that were standing on the stage. OK, These are people that don't worry about that don't wait for 9 hours in an ER. Okay, that aren't concerned about putting food on their table. Honestly, have very little to do with the reality of raising children in work and
right.
working
the
way
are
we
they
do.
Worried about rent, they have multiple homes.
Exactly, and what they're doing is that they're taking off the chessboard people who may be opposed to them, may be able to be a bumper for their behaviors. And I do think this is playing a role, particularly with Musk and what he would like to do with his own companies and with AI, that this is the step that he needs to take in order to be able to further put his snout into the public trough, which he has gotten exceedingly wealthy from.
And I think, you know, right, what could go wrong? You know, we're giving this person
everything.
Access to all of our information, all of our data, your social security number, everything, every resource that you have ever utilized and that there is a record of. And so, but I think that that's right. In the absence of transparency, people assume corruption. And none of us, and my co-panelists are way smarter than I am, but they have not been able to say, this is a good reason why this would be done, or I think that this is what they're trying to accomplish. And so if we can't figure it out, right, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, I've worked in the private sector. I was the vice president and general counsel of a publicly traded company. Sometimes we had to make difficult decisions when a product line was discontinued or we lost a customer. And so, you know, I get it, but I can't figure out what it is that they're trying to do because it makes absolutely no sense. And they haven't articulated what's wrong with what's there or where the waste is or why, you know, we need to lay off 10% of our workforce so that we don't have to raise taxes. Something, anything. But none of that has been articulated. So people are assuming conspiracy or corruption. That's how it works.
But the irony, though, let's talk about, you know, 25% of the federal workforce. If you laid off 25% of the federal workforce, you'd save about 1% of the budget. Okay. So we're making a lot of splash about a very small savings. And you said something that's really important, Matt. In the private sector, you stop doing something. Okay. What line of work are we going to get out of? We're going to cut and move on. Okay, what is the government not going to do now? And that's a conversation that they don't want to have with us. The other part of the conversation that you know, let's stop tiptoeing around it, everybody. If you're going to get money, you're going to have to go to Social Security, Medicare, the social safety net. Okay, let's be honest about what you're going to do. Okay.
Well, I wish somebody would just like be a grown up and say, Social Security, we're going to have to change the retirement age just by a little bit. I mean, you can fix that. You can just move it. People are living longer. Move it by a year and, you know, voila, you've solved half the problem. But like, that's taboo. No elected official is ever going to do it because all of the people who are impacted by it are going to get mad and vote against them.
But do you know how angry I'm going to be if a billionaire is telling me I got to work longer and harder so that they can get a tax break?
It'd
you know
be better
something?
If Jimmy Carter did it, right?
Well,
like, so
you know,
like,
something? I'm sorry, but that dog don't hunt for this guy.
All right. Well, maybe not for you. Like, but it doesn't have. It wouldn't apply to you. It apply to people who are entering the workforce now. Right, they have to work a year. Like, what is it? Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree. That's why, you know, taxes on the ultra wealthy, we can all agree, because we're not ultra wealthy, that's who should be taxed, right? Because it's not us. But no, my point is, there are ways to fix this, but nobody has the cojones to do it. I don't know, is that a bad word on air?
I don't think so. No, okay. I don't think it is. 1 minute, Mayor Chan.
I just think that we all need to pay attention, and that there are many people out there who feel very, very weighed down by all of these things that are happening, and they feel powerless. And that's exactly how the powerful want you to feel. And so find something. I go onto the website and fill a grocery cart from Amazon for refugees once a week. It makes me feel good. They need things like diapers and soup. You know, this isn't really expensive stuff. Find your way to be empowered. Stay informed. Pay attention. And we all need to ensure that we are ultimately holding those who are elected to these highest offices are held accountable.
That is the end of the panel for this morning. Thank you all for being here. Panelists were Bob Griffin, Heather Mulligan, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan. Joe will be back tomorrow, and the Congressional Corner is next.